Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello, Guy.
Hello, Gary.
It's the Raconteurs, isn't it, really?
Oh, very good.
I mean, I think this if our show was ever designed for anyone, it's probably Rick Wakeman.
Well, it is and it isn't, in that we're not really needed here.
A very famous raconteur, as he is, you know, he's on tour, I think, just about to go on tour. Doing his I think it's the not quite as grumpy as last year tour, where he talks through songs and he plays them and tells stories and gags. And hopefully he can tell a few of those here today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hopefully, as per usual, one will get a few that you don't hear from him.
You know what? I was thinking about the period when we all sort of discovered Rick Wakeman, or people of our age, as it were.
Yeah.
And how different times are today to then. I mean, obviously, guitar heroes, we had those. But there were keyboard heroes in those days. I mean, people, you'd play air keyboards, wouldn't you? But you wouldn't play it like Mrs. Mills with your hands in front of you. You'd play it as though
That's
you had...
That's right, left and right. Yeah.
You know,
like
you had
like wings. That's right. Because he was absolutely the guy for that. I remember looking at the ring. He had one thing, which I think was just a sort of box with 2 VU meters in it. And I was like, wow, what is that?
I know. And he had mirrors behind him as well to make it look like he had even more keyboards than he really had. And of course, the sequin cape. But, you know, thinking about those great heroes of the time, you know, John Lord, Mike Garson, Keith Emerson, Tony Banks.
Rick Wright,
of course. You know, that's an extraordinary time. I mean, can you imagine kids of today getting excited about keyboard players?
No, well, just stuff in general. The whole point is it's all in your phone.
Exactly. I'm really excited. I think there's going to be lots of tales to tell, because not only has he played on some of the most famous records. Do you know what? I didn't realise he played on Get It On, T-Rex's Get It On.
Yes, that's right. And I'll be honest, I found that out researching this as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I actually think the P word doesn't even need to appear this week. We're just in, aren't we?
This is it. This is the man that invented the P word, really, didn't he? And of course, but Life on Mars, famously, and then his solo album sold millions. Yeah. And he famously did one where he did
on
a show
ice.
On ice.
There's a funny story about that I want to ask him about. Well, yes, I'm sure he'll tell us anyway. Let's get him on. Come on, enough of us waffling.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune, for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
I've listened to a few of them, and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
I know you're musicians, but you've been more professional than a lot of journalists.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, hello.
Sorry about this.
<That's okay.
laughs> Sorry about this. Race finished. Just grab my tin and shut the door.
Can we see you, Rick? Is there any chance of seeing your face if you go...
Yeah, hold on. Should be. Where's that bit?
Down the bottom left-hand corner. Start video or something.
Oh, yeah, I've got it. There you go.
Yay!
Sorry about this. We're in the middle of moving house, and we were down at the other house where the builders are all there, and builders being what builders are, there was more tea being drunk than work going on. so we were late getting back. Apologies for that. And then
that's all right.
Then attacked by the dogs.
Have you moved from dis to dat?
We've just moved a bit further south, just south of Ipswich.
Didn't Johnny Depp buy a house up there?
Yeah, Johnny Depp's got a place in Eye. Claudia Schaefer's got a place up here. Griff Rhys-Jones. There's Ian Lavender, of course. Yeah, bless him. Ian's been here for years now.
Yeah. Is he still a boy?
You know, the amazing thing is, how old is Ian now? 70, 76, I think. He's still, you walk down the street with him and you still get, and I lie to you not, don't tell him your name, Pike. It's the most shouted out thing in the street. Even though he's like 70 odd now, he is still incredibly recognisable.
Wow.
Yeah. How did the tour go in America, Rick?
It was good. It's strange over there. It really is strange. I mean, you've got half the country who think it's all a hoax, and the other half who are totally and utterly paranoid. Most of the hotels closed all their restaurants. It is very bizarre, but it was all right. It was good. I mean, it's very strange looking out at an audience where everybody's wearing masks. It's a bit like a Lone Ranger convention. It's very weird. people were really good and they're very careful.
And what was it like for you in terms of protocols and everything? Were you, I mean, like, well,
it was
backstage?
Good. It was good. I mean, I knew what it was before I went. Because so many bands and people over there have got part of their crews and they have caught COVID and everything's cancelled. The number of cancellations is phenomenal. So the rules are very strict. Easy because it was a one-man show, so there's only four of us travelling in two vehicles. The audiences are very strict over there. They had to have the COVID certificates, plus they had to be tested 2 days before and a test on the day when they were there. Very, very strict.
Yeah, we're going out in January, so we're keen to know what it's like.
Yeah, and nobody allowed backstage. But, you know, a bit weird at first, but after you get used to it, you go, okay, this makes sense. They're just being doubly precautious, which you can understand when you see the list of bands who've had huge problems over there.
But, do you find as one gets older and, you know, dare I say it, grumpier, the idea of no one coming backstage is actually very appealing?
I must admit, it's the amount of time that was saved. One of the things that we did was we just used four hotels and used them as hubs. So we would drive maybe two and a half hours to a show, then drive back. And one of the things, you're quite right, when nobody came back afterwards, suddenly you're out. You haven't got, you know, gone is the Liggers pit. You know, you don't know where, you know, which we used to do on one of the last Yes tours that I did. We sectioned off an area of every venue and where we put what we call the blaggers in. You know them, you know, really well. We come in one of the tickets. And then once they were seated at the front, there was a release of a banner that came down that just said Liggers Pit.
harsh, but fair.
It was. So, but you know, obviously you have friends that you would like to see and you don't. But what was amazing was you come off stage, get in the car and you're gone. Because one of the other things as well, security wouldn't allow anybody at the back with stuff to sign.
No.
They were all told beforehand, couldn't happen. So you get in the car and suddenly, you know, you come off stage at 10 and instead of leaving there normally at like 11:15 or something daft, by midnight, you're back in your room.
Brilliant.
It is interesting. It does work. And the same... I mean, the meet and greets we did, but they were really carefully controlled. They were in another building. No, they were down on... I was on stage looking down at them.
That's worth $1,000, Rick. That's worth $1,000. Just to be close.
The meet and greet Zoom.
Yeah, you're right. And, what we did... And we did with the... with the photos, one side of the piano, another, they had a route to go up... I mean, Live Nation who organised the meet and greet. I mean, so strict. And, you know, on the first I said, is it really necessary to be this strict? And then I was read the list of musos and bands on the road where they'd had to stop because somebody had got it.
Well, yeah. Genesis, so, Bon Jovi.
Yeah. It's worth it. I saw Tony Levin while I was over there.
Oh, dear Tony.
The lovely Tony. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. On the last show, which was in Woodstock, and Tony came and he sort of shouted from outside, I've got two jabs, a booster jab. I've had more pricks than anybody would ever care to wish. I thought, well, I won't go into that. And so I did see Tone, which was great. And he said it's been pretty terrible. Well,
they were the first out. I think King Crimson were the first people to venture out, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Yeah. And he said it was very weird. He said it was really, really weird. But
well, you're in a band with Robert Fripp. I mean, it's bound to be.
No, I got an email from Robert, didn't I, Guy?
I know you did.
Robert was saying how terrifying it was out there, you know, that everyone was so worried because you know, you've got your money on the line. You know, that's going to be your money if suddenly you can't play anymore, you know?
I know. It's really hard. I mean, it was strange looking down, as I said earlier, at a sea of masks, but it was great to get out and be playing. And you could sense that we're moving closer, albeit slowly, to the time when there's an element of normality. I still think it'll be towards the end of next year before it'll be true sort of normality. But it just shows that it can be done if you're careful and audiences are careful. Tony said to me, some bands out there, they're going, oh, it'll be fine.
Rick, you know, look, researching your career, it's huge, right? It branches everywhere. So we're just going to pick a few of those great fruits.
I said to Gary, if you go and look you up on Apple Music, you're not an artist, you're a genre.
Yeah, but that basically translated means I'm old.
No, listen, not really.
It means you're industrious.
You just haven't stopped. But some of the stuff you've delivered over the decades has been, you know, I mean, it's priceless and it's with us forever. We would love to go back to talk about some of that early stuff and about you, we all know you were, you know, a child prodigy at keyboards and a piano, but just the beginning of you getting into rock music, who was turning you on? I mean, other than the old classical writers.
Well, I was very lucky because my dad was a great pianist and he had a concert party with my mum before the war. So there was music going on in the house all the time. Dad was playing the piano. It was a good piano player in the style of Charlie Coons, the old great stride piano player. And during the war years, he often said he was like being shot at on the front line somewhere out in Italy, and then he was being dragged off to go and play for Billy Cotton or Harry Seacon, and then taken back to be shot at. He said it was bizarre, but because there was music going on all the time, and my dad encouraged me to listen and play as many different kinds of music as I could. My early heroes. I suppose my first real early hero was Lonnie Donegan. Because skiffle was great because everybody could have a skiffle band. You know, a tea chest, a piece of wood and a bit of string, something to rattle, an old washboard. And I'm old enough that every house had a washboard. And it was just, it was great. And I talked to Lonnie. I got to know Lonnie many years later. I got to know him really well and talked to him about those days, and he said, well, that's really how it all started, because it was something that you didn't need any money. And in fact, if you had somebody who had a guitar, however cheap or whatever, you're laughing, you know, with an acoustic guitar, the old washboard and the old T-chest bass, you got a band.
Was this stuff sort of I mean, you obviously love classical music as well, right? You must have.
Yeah.
So did you compartmentalise it, or was it all the same, hitting the same spot with you?
Really weirdly, I always thought music is music. I never.
Yeah, everyone says that, but.
Well, it was one of the things when I always wanted to do stuff when I was in, even before I went to the Royal College of Music and after. I wanted to do one of the things that I couldn't get my head around was I loved orchestras playing pop music, popular music of the day. I thought it was really, really good, except that a lot of the musicians didn't understand it. And while you can write the notes, you can't write a feel. But I always felt the other thing that was wrong, there was a few bands, a few musicians playing with some orchestral instruments, but it was the them and us. It was not the same. And when I did things like, finally got to do things like Journey and King Arthur, I wrote the band as part of the orchestra. They weren't band and then you add on an orchestra. They were all part of the orchestra. And I always thought that would actually be the thing that worked. And
unlike a sort of Deep Purple live in Japan.
Well, I was going to say, because I did John Lord's concerto for group and orchestra many times with him. And in fact, did the recording with him. And he always said about, like, when they were at the Albert Hall, there was like outright hostility, basically, between
John was a very close friend of mine, as you know.
I adored John, yeah.
And we talked about it a lot. I mean, I love John to bits, bless him. You know, he said, well, also Ian Paice told me it was World War II when they did that concert. I said, how did you cope with it? And Ian said, basically, we went round the pub and let John get on with it and came back. And he said that was the only way to deal with it, because he said the orchestra, and back then they didn't get it. I'll tell you something that's interesting. Many years later, in 1999, I recorded a sequel to Journey to the Centre of the Earth called Return to the Centre of the Earth.
That's right, yeah.
And I used the London Symphony Orchestra again. And what was stunning was that it was a completely different mindset. They got it straight away. And one of the things that I will always remember was we did one of the pieces, and there was about 30 of them came up into the control room. This was at the old CTS in Wembley. And about 30 of them came to the control room. And they're always nattering when they come in. And the conversation, I always remember the first thing, he said, how many of us are going to Ozfest this year? What?
Yeah.
And so when they said, oh, yeah, it's great, we're going to Ozfest, and then we're going off to Glastonbury, and we're going, not Glastonbury, to trying to think where it was then. Anyway, they were off to some festival and things. And I said, oh, yeah. And suddenly, and it showed in their playing, they got, even though you can't write Phil musically, they got it and they understood it. And I talked to a lot of them after, and they said, well, things have changed. There's no longer the them and us. You know, we all feel part of the same group.
Yeah, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I will mention the fact, because you were talking about how all music is music and influences, all these different influences that were in your life, from classical to jazz or whatever. And you know, your calling card as a kid when you're about 20 years old is Temperament of Mind that you do with Straubs. And yeah. you do that in the live album, the Antiques and Curios, that album at the Festival Hall. And you listen to that piece, and I listened again today, and you've got all musical styles going on in there. You've got boogie woogie, you've got classical, you've got baroque.
Yeah, well, what happened was it was at Sheffield University we were playing initially with Straubs, and for some unknown reason we lost all power on stage, and so basically I was sitting at the piano. Dave Cousins and Tony Hooper at the guitar, and there was nothing. They couldn't sing, couldn't do anything. The PA was off. Had some percussion to bang, but that was it. John Ford, no, nothing for his bass. And Dave just walked up to the front of the stage and shouted out, "Rick will now do a piano solo." And I went, "Rick will what?" And I said, I didn't have a party piece or anything like that. And I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Whatever comes into your mind." So I just sat down, and I treated it a bit like I do sometimes I sort of play every day, and sometimes it can be a piece I'm working on, sometimes it can be practicing a piece, sometimes it can just be anything that comes to mind. So I was sitting there at the piano, also keeping one eye on seeing if there's any lights going to come on any of the amps or whatever it was. And when I sort of ran out of the first bit that I was playing, I then went into, I thought, oh, a silent movie. I'll have a silent movie. And I did that. And then there was the old cigar advert. I can't remember what it was.
Hamlet. Air on a G-string.
So I threw that in. And basically, I just kept going until I saw some lights on and a signal from Dave that we were back working again. The difficulty was that it went down well. And I did it. It was literally about a week later that we were at QE Hall doing just a collection of Antiques and Curios, the album live. And Dave said, "You should do that again." And I said, "Well, I can probably only do it once more, because otherwise it's not how I'm feeling. It's not an ad lib as I feel. Mm-hmm. It'll be a rehearsed piece." So I literally only did it that once, and I think one other time. And by then it had started to get organized. So it didn't work. But it was great fun to do.
But the story finishes, doesn't it? Because that particular recording was in July 1970. And that week, the Melody Maker had a picture of you on the front cover with Tomorrow's Superstar. Is that true, Rick?
It is true, but they'd sort of run out of front covers. So it was an element of desperation. Who can they stick on? Yeah, because it was very funny, that QE Hall show. It got reviews in the Times, the Financial Times, would you believe, the Guardian, and loads of other sort of broadsheets at the time. And a lot of that, I think, was down to the fact that it was a midweek concert. And there weren't many midweek concerts going on in London at the time. So we got quite a bit of press out of it. But also for a live band of two basic acoustic guitars, no drummer, but a percussionist, had surrounded himself with everything he could bang or hit. And John Ford on a slap bass, although it was an electric bass, but he played like a slap. And I by that time, had added an L100 Hammond organ, which was falling apart, but great. And a few other little bits and pieces. And suddenly, for a strange musical lineup, we had quite a unique little sound.
Yeah.
And everybody knew what they were doing. And Dave Cousins, strange voice, but it works, and the Strawbs people love it. But it works so well with Tony Hooper. Tony had a real angelic voice, and it worked brilliantly. It sort of calmed Dave's voice down quite a lot, which was great. So it was quite an unusual sound and setup, and it worked. I was very proud of Strawbs, and I think, and that truly was a live concert, because Tony Visconti, I think, had three mics. That was it, to try and deal with everything, and a couple of other DI things in to the back of the theatre. No editing. We didn't have the money to go in and repair anything. So it was warts and all, the whole show. And I've listened to it in recent years and thought, you know what, for a live show, it had a lot of energy. It was nice, and some nice songs. And I'm really proud of it. And for what started off when I joined them the year before as a folk band, and suddenly you've got Hammond organs and all that sort of thing going on with Wild Wild pedals, and which was great fun. Very folk-like. I mean, I remember when we first put that all together and went into a couple of folk clubs, which is where we were playing, and the sort of the Kaftan Brigade absolutely crapped themselves. They couldn't believe what was going on.
I love the Kaftan. Now, but you've mentioned a name in there, which is something we really want to cover, which is Tony Visconti, who you've done a lot of important stuff with. Already by then, hadn't you, I would have thought?
Yeah, Tony, I'd worked with Tony on a lot of sessions for...
Because you were a total session dog for a while there, weren't you? You were like...
I was.
Who are you up against? It's always interesting to know who are the... Like, if you're up for a session, who else was up for it?
Well, it was quite interesting. There were some very good people around.
Nicky Hopkins, I guess.
All a lot, yeah, and they were all a lot older than me.
Right.
Which Steve Gray, the late Steve Gray, was. I mean, I was, when I first started doing this, I was, 19 in sort of 60 or 67, I was 18. And I started then, and all the other pianists and things were, and organists were basically all in their 30s and 40s, which was like ancient back then.
Yeah, of course.
What was the first session?
My first session was for a guy called Jimmy Thomas, who was the original singer for Ike and Tina Turner Band. And Jimmy's, he's living in London now. He's still around. He's got to be well in his 80s. And Jimmy came over from America to record an album and record a couple of singles. And he was signed by Denny Cordell.
Oh, right.
At A&M Records. And I got booked by default because some of his band were coming in, and only one or two made it past the airport, something to do with not getting through customs because they had some things they shouldn't have with them. And they all got arrested and flown back. So there was a mate of mine who said, look, they're desperate for an organist. Can you come and do it? And I went, yeah. And they went, oh, also, they need some brass arrangements. Can you do that? And I went, well, yeah, they went, great. Next Friday, they gave me a little quarter-inch tape to work with, but I mean, I was still at the Royal College of Music. I didn't have a tape recorder, so my dad lent me 30 quid to buy a tape recorder. That was a disaster because the tape recorder ran at 7.5 and 3.75, and the tape was at 15. So I was bugging before we started.
Well, it's good for learning it though, nice slow.
Yeah, that's very true. But But I got the arrangements done, and then they said, "Oh, can you book the brass band?" Well, luckily I was playing at the Top Rank Ballroom in the Ronnie Smith All Star Band, which was a 17-piece soul band, brilliant band.
Oh, that sounds great!
Great people in it, and all the brass players were the session players during the day, and then they worked at the Top Rank during the night. They either did the Top Rank or the Mecca Circuit. So I called up one of the guys who I knew. I said, "Look, help, please! I'm out of my depth here. Can you book?" So he booked me, and I remember it was a trombone, a trumpet, and tenor sax that he booked for me. So I did the arrangement, and then went to the Olympic Studios in Barnes, as it was then. I'd never been in a big boy studio before. Loads of demo studios, but not a big boy studio. And Olympic was a big boy studio. And I went in there, and there in the studio was the remains of Jimmy's band, who had not been arrested. And and I say this in the nicest sense, the only other white guy there was Denny Cordell in the control room. They said that, "You do it." I said, I'm doing the hammer. They went, "Right, okay." Right. So,
Viking has come to do the hammer.
Yeah, absolutely. So they played. They ran the track through.
If you had your cape, you would have been fine.
They ran the track, and I sort of played along. But I played in the only style I could do. And then I played it, and then they did a couple of takes. And then Denny Cordell said, "Can the organ player please come into the studio?" Into the control room. So I went in the control room, and I'll be honest with you, I lied through my back teeth. I said, "Look, before we go any further, you probably want like a Booker T type thing for this. I can sort of do it, but it's not really what I do, to be brutally honest with you." And Danny Cordell said, "No, that's exactly not what I want you to do. I want you to do exactly what you're doing, because it's different." He said, and I would suggest that you'd always try and be your own man for all of your stuff. And he said, "I haven't seen you around in any of the studios." And I didn't lie. I sort of didn't. I said, "Well, I've been away," which is true. I'd been on holiday to Exmouth in Devon. And and he went, "Oh, right." And then I always remember he said, "I want you to come up and see me tomorrow in the Dumbarton House in Oxford Street," which was Regal's Honifer. He said, "I want to have a chat with you." And I said, "I can't." Actually, no, I was still at school. I wasn't even at the Royal College then. I said, "I can't." I said, "Because I've got a maths exam." And he said, "Are you at school?" And I went, "Oh, shit. Yeah, I'm at school." And he went, "Well, how important is the maths exam?" I said, "Well, got to do it." He said, "Oh, are you going to do maths for a living?" I went, no, I'm not. He said, "Well," he said, "at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'll know when you arrive at 68 Dumbarton House whether you really want to be a musician or you want to take your maths exam." And I was there at 7:30 in the morning outside his door, and went in, and he introduced me to Tony Visconti. This is the long answer to your question. Yeah, he introduced me to Tony Visconti and Gus Dudgeon, who were the two staff producers up there. And that was it. And then Tony he introduced me to bands like Junior's Eyes, which I did stuff for.
We were just talking about that before you came on. Gary was talking about, what was the track, Gary?
Didn't Junior's Eyes were from Hull, weren't they? The sort of predecessors of the Spiders from Mars.
They were. They were very much indeed. And they were a good band too. They were a very good band. And
Battersea Power Station was the album, wasn't it?
Yeah, Battersea Power Station, which has just appeared on CD. I mean, we recorded it at Morgan Studios before Morgan had really been built properly. And it was just great. I went along there and did that. And that is where, in the corner, they just had delivered a Mellotron, and all the Mellotrons originally were double manual things. And it was in the corner. So I'd done my bit, and they were doing stuff in the control room. And I said to the engineer, that I can't remember who it was. And I said, "Any chance of having a look at that Mellotron in the corner?" He said, yeah, "Help yourself." He said, "We're going to be in here. We're not going to, you won't disturb us," he said, "but you won't keep it in tune. Nightmare, we can't," he says. So I went over and plugged it in and played away, and then I'd be
Strawberry Fields.
Yeah, absolutely. Did all the usual crap. And then sussed out reasons why it wouldn't stay in tune, and then what you could do to sort of cheat it a bit.
Well, it's the tape, isn't it? It's the tape wall.
Yeah, it was the tape. Yeah, but one of the things is, instead of, it really played block chords and things on it, which wasn't the right thing to do. If you play like a four-note chord, literally every 2 seconds you release one of the keys. So you still got your chords and then do another one. So in other words, you're constantly changing that. Then you don't get the 8 second delay. And also it's not a strain on the motor, which is why it goes out of tune. The way
smooths it out.
And it worked. And I sussed out, and Tony Visconti came and he went, "How are you keeping that in tune?" And I said, "Well," I said, "no, don't tell me." He said, you'll learn from that. I went, "Oh, okay." And then it was beginning of 1969. I was still at the top ranked ballroom, but this time I was in Reading. Previous to that, I'd been at Watford, and I was at I was down there one afternoon. Why was I down there? Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, I got a call, and it was from Tony Visconti. He said, "You're wanted at Trident Studios, with Ken Scott, and I think Gus was down there." And he said, "David, who I'd met once up at Regal Xenophon, is doing a new single. He wants a Mellotron on it. They can't keep it in tune." And I said, "You can." I went, "Oh, great, thank you."
That's an amazing thing. The guy who can play a Mellotron in tune.
In tune, I know.
Tony Visconti wasn't producing. He was producing the Space Oddity album, but he didn't like that single, did he?
Yeah.
He didn't.
Why is he booking the session?
Well, he and Gus Judson were great friends. And one of the things that were really on, if Tony had something that he thought Gus could do a better job with, he'd pass it over, and the same with Gus. They did pass a lot of stuff around. So I went up there, Tony wasn't there. And I always remember I walked in and David said, you'll find this a piece of cake. I went, "Oh, great." And he said, "Have you ever played a piece of cake before?" And I said, "Oh, it's going to be one of those sessions, is it?" And
so that's Bowie said that to you, did he?
Yeah. So we did it. It's very simple to play and do. And I fiddled around and kept the thing in tune. Dave was really happy. And then afterwards he said, "I've heard some of your piano playing. Would you like to do some piano stuff for me?" And I said, "Yeah, crikey, I'd love to." So a lot of it all stemmed from that Mellotron. And I kept on working for both Gus and Tony Visconti, and of course Ken.
Because you did get it on with Mark Bonan. I had no idea. You know, that was, I think, the second single I ever bought, Rick. I mean, that was, you know, such an important record in my life, and I didn't know you were on it.
Well, it was during a period of time where I was financially embarrassed, which was interesting at the time because I hadn't yet started getting divorced. And I was up in London because I was £8 short for my rent for Mrs. Cleary in Ilford. Well, Gants Hill, where I had a flat.
Ferry Hancock, Mrs. Cleary in Ilford.
Yeah, Mrs. Cleary. I'm trying to think of the name of the road.
Oil Drum Lane.
It wasn't far off it. Yeah, she was a widower at the top of the house, and I live with my wife in the bottom part, but had very little. You had great weeks doing sessions, then you had some terrible weeks. I never put anything to one side. The only thing I put to one side was my glasses in the pub when I'd had another drink. So I never had any spare cash. And this was a particularly bad week, a bad month. I was £8 short. And I went up to London on the train from Gants Hill. And then I went all down Tin Pan Alley, down Denmark Street, to Southern Music and Places. Because there was always a demo session or something going. You could always earn a couple of quid from a demo session for a couple. So I went, amazing, nothing going. So I went to Regal Xenophon. They had a little demo studio as well. And I spoke to the guys up there. I said, "Anything going there?" "Nothing. There's absolutely nothing." And Mark was up there, Mark Boland, who I knew. And he said, "Come on, let's go and have a drink." So we went, there was a Wimpy Bar on the corner, the opposite corner to Dumbarton House. And we went in there, and I think he bought the bottle of Coke and two straws, and sort of drank that. And then I'm now thinking, right, all I can do now is hang around in London until I know Mrs. Cleary's gone to bed, then get the last train down to Gants Hill, and like sneak in the door.
The glamour!
The un-rock and rollness of this is just fantastic.
Well, what happened was, I was leaving, and in fact, I was walking back down Oxford Street towards, from Dumbarton House towards Tottenham Court Road Station. And Tony Visconti was there. He said, "Rick, session tonight in Trident Studios, midnight, for Mark Boland doing a new single. He wants you to do the piano." I went, I love you. This is rent, because that's £9, you see. That's not only have I got the £8 for the rent, but I've got a drink on it as well, you know. So I went to the studio. This is absolutely true. I went in there and went down, and there's his band, all the usual guy, you know, who I knew playing it. And Mark ran through the song on his guitar. And then they're all like joining in and things. And I said, Mark, he said, what? I said, there is no piano on this. There is no piano part at all. I said, trust me, if I could find something that would work, it would, but anything on there would take away from the rawness of what you're trying to achieve. And he said, oh, all I want you to do is this. And they ran it through again, and he ran a gliss from the top of the piano to the bottom. He said, I want you to do that every time I nod at you. And I said, that's very kind of you. I said, but you could do that. He said, well, do you want your £9 or not?
Yeah, exactly. I said, your own worst enemy here, Rick.
And I said, well, yeah. He said, look, I could give you the £9 or loan it to you. He said, but you wouldn't take it, would you? I said, well, no, probably not. He says, right, so you can earn it. You can sit here till 3 a.m. doing glisses. So that's what I did. I mean, it was lovely. I mean, that was the sort of the camaraderie that was around at the time. That's it nice. Was brilliant.
Taking the gliss.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You went to Haddon Hall, didn't you, when Bowie had written the Hunky Dory album? Because this is just incredible. This is really you in the making, isn't it? Your real identity.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was very interesting, because I still get quite emotional about Haddon Hall, because it's gone now. They pulled it down. Contrary to a lot of beliefs, David didn't own it. He rented it.
Yeah.
So it was the owners who pulled it down. Bloody stupid.
And it wasn't, because it sounds quite grand, doesn't it? But it
wasn't
big,
grand.
No, exactly.
But in a strange way, it was for me, because it had like a minstrel's gallery and all that kind of thing. And I'm living in a really small little terraced house in West Harrow. So, yeah, it did seem glamorous to me when I went. And he called me up and said, I'm doing a new album and I want it to be very piano orientated. Can you come round the house in Beckenham? So I said, yeah, he said, bring your wife. He said, because Adji's here, because it was just been born. The boy had just come into the world. And so we went round there, and my missus at the time, they, you know, played with Adji and the kid. And we went up to the minstrel's gallery, had a nice grand piano, and he had a battered old 12-string guitar. He said, let me play you these songs. He said, make some notes. And I brought some manuscript paper, so I wrote down notes and calls and things and went along, one after the other. And I just said, these great songs. They said, yeah, new album, it's going to be hunky-dory, but I want it to be very much, in many cases, piano-orientated. So we played all through it, and then he came, he played me Life on Mars. And
did he play that on the guitar? Yeah. I mean, it's the most complicated song ever written.
Yeah, it is quite good, but he sort of played it on the guitar. And by this time, I got used to his writing, because I'd done things like Wild Eye Boy from Free Cloud with him and Memory of the Free Festival.
I knew how he thought.
Isn't that with a pump organ, the Wild Eye Boy from...
Sorry?
Has that got a pump?
A harmonium. It's a harmonium.
I think there is a harmonium on it, as well as piano. And Tony Visconti did a great orchestral arrangement of it as well, which is really good on that track. He played me live and I said, what a great song. And he said, oh, thank you. He said, play it through on the piano. I said, how do you want me to play it? And he said, you know how I want you to play it. I said, no, I'm asking you how you want me to play it. So I play it. He said, you know how I want you to play it. Play it. So I played it through. He said, that's how I want you to play it.
Wow.
He said, and he gave me one bit of advice, which I've tried to keep to as best as possible. He said, when you're doing something and a song, he said, always think of the musicians who are going to play it. And always pick on musicians that what you think will understand what you're trying to achieve. You can have the best musicians in the world, but if they don't understand what you're trying to achieve, you're not going to get that.
Wow.
So he said, that's what I do all the time. He said, so that's why I knew that you'd play it as I wanted it, whether you realised it or not.
Well, Rick, can I just say one little thing? Because that is, it's like, you know, one of the great piano performances of all time. And in fact, is now such accepted part of the fabric of life. When my son did his grade 6 piano exam, that was his, he was accepted prepared piece to do.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I know that the day before it was recorded, Mick Ronson, who was sort of, I think he was, he slept up on the minstrels gallery. And he was up all night frantically trying to write that string arrangement, because Mick wrote that string arrangement. Did you?
He did.
Did you work together with him on that?
No, but I did work closely with Mick. Mick and I got on great. We got on really, really, really well. In fact, the whole band, Woody and Trevor, they all stayed at Haddon Hall. They all stayed there and rehearsed, practiced, drank, and did other illicit things. It was an amazing place. But Mick, I got on great with Mick, and we talked a lot about one of the reasons the arrangement was late is because David wanted it very much to be around the piano, which was one of the things that was quite interesting. That I had a lot of people say to me, oh, you must have spent hours and hours working out the piano part for that around everything else that was going on. And the truth of the matter is that everybody had to work around me because that's how David wanted it. So I actually had the easy task.
Right, right. Who was on the telephone at the end?
The telephone. Well, basically, it was a side room with a telephone in it. And what happened was, at the end of one of the takes, the telephone rang. And of course, it ended up on the master, on the multi-track. But then, as you know, back then, tape was bloody expensive. And everybody was under some sort of budget. So what you did, if you had a series of tapes that you knew you were never going to keep because they weren't good enough, you ran the tape back and ran it again.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happened until the tape we got that everybody was delighted with, you know, especially Ken Scott and Tony. They were really delighted with that take. And then, of course, when they played it back, when the tape stopped, there was the phone from the previous ages ago
still there.
And they went, oh, God, what do we do there? And Dave said, keep it. He said, just keep it. I like it. He said, meant to be. So that's why it's there. And it's really funny. I spoke to Ken last year. No, the beginning of this year. And I said, did anybody ever find out whoever it was on the phone? He said, no. He said, they're probably still hanging on now. I've got no clue.
We've got to get to Yes.
Right, so, you know, we have, yeah. I mean, listen, there's one story on the way, though, that I did find out today, that you bought your first Mini Moog from the Artful Dodger.
Oh, that's right, from Jack Wilde.
Is that true?
Yeah, 30 quid.
And what?
Well, I just joined Yes, and I needed a Mini Moog, and I
oh, you say Moog, you're of the Moog school.
Yeah,
well, I've spoken to Bob when he was alive about this, and his daughter. He's got three daughters. And he could never remember their names, so they were known as Mini Moog 1, Mini Moog 2, and Mini Moog 3. And Michelle is Mini Moog 3, and I spoke to Michelle in the
middle one should have been Midi Moog.
Oh, excellent, yeah. And I spoke to Michelle, and I spoke to Bob as well. I said, is it Moog or Moog? And he said, I don't mind. He said, whatever people want, it's fine by me. So nobody truly, really ever knows whether it's... I spoke to Michelle. I said, what do you do, Michelle? She said, well, it's just whatever anybody calls me, really.
But hang on. Jack Wilde, the Artful Dodger.
All right, okay. How this came about...
H.R. Puff and stuff, more the point.
That's it, his vote. Yeah. He was... Yes was signed to Hemdale, which was David Hemmings and John Daly management.
And that's why you ended up using David Hemmings on Genesis.
Exactly, yeah. And we were signed, and also signed to Hemdale was Black Sabbath, and there's quite a few bits floating around. And they also The manager of Yes,
you played
Brian
with them.
Lane.
Was that through that? Didn't you? You worked with Sabbath, didn't you? Yes.
Yeah. That's sort of.
Sorry.
Slightly. I mean, I just became great friends with all of the guys and did stuff with them, and still am. In fact, my son Adam's been with them 21 years now.
That's right.
So
yeah.
There you go. But the. Where was I? Hemdale, something.
Jack Wild.
I was just going to ask you what my name was. Jack Wild. He was signed to them as well. He was off doing Puff and stuff and things. And he and Brian Lane, my manager, called me up and he said, "Do you want to buy a Mini Moog? Do you know what it is?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, do you want to buy one?" I said, "Well." I said, "They're over £1,000. I haven't got £1,000. I then just joined yesterday." And he said, "Well," and we were getting, I was getting £28 a week with Straubs. So I said, "I can't afford them anyway." He said, it's very cheap." I said, "Well, how cheap?" He said, £30. I said, "Well, what's wrong with it? Everything." He said, "No, it's still all wrapped up, really." He said, "It just doesn't work, apparently," Jack said. And he just said, "Would I like it? Get rid of it." So I said, "Well, I thought, 30 quid, I'll give you 30 quid. Even if it doesn't work, I'll put it on stage because it'll look bloody good." So I went up to South Street in London, in Mayfair, where the offices were, and I picked up this Mini Moog and I got it back to my house in West Harrow. And I thought, it was mint. And I thought, okay. So I plugged it in and I thought, I'll leave it on soak 24 hours and see what, put the headphones in. And it worked perfectly. Couldn't find anything wrong with it. So I thought, well, I'll leave it on soak, see what happens. In the morning, tried again, absolutely perfectly. Tried in the afternoon, absolutely perfectly. Nothing wrong with it. So I phoned up Brian, my manager. I said, "Brian, I've got to tell you, this Mini Moog, I said, there's nothing wrong with it. I said, I've given it on soak. I've given it lots of tests. I've given it all the usual batterings. There is nothing wrong with it." He said, "Well, I'll call Jack. He's in America." So he called Jack and he came back to me. He said, "Jack said it doesn't work." I said, "Well, it does. What is it that he says doesn't work?" He said, "Jack said it only plays one note at a time. It won't." And I said, "Brian, it's a monophonic instrument. That means it plays one note at a time. Nobody makes polyphonic synthesizer things."
Oh, he thought he was going to sit there playing "Consider Yourself."
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And so Brian said, "I'll call him back." So Brian called him back, came back to me and said, "Jack said, well, it's no effing good to me. Tell Rick he can have it for 30 quid.
Oh, so, I was hoping on a story where the two of you were in the Bag of Nails and he sold it for drink.
No, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, I had met Jack before because I'd played on some of his records.
Of course you had.
I did the Bicycle Bell, which was one with him, which was the bicycle song, which is it was bloody awful, but another 9 quid. And I got his Mini Moog. That was my first Mini Moog.
Because you ended up with like four. It was funny because yesterday I was watching your Six Wives of Henry VIII, and it's because I remember just when I was a kid just being so impressed by your rig. And you had something like four Mini Moogs. And of course, now looking at it, you realize the type, like, you're playing this melody. And then you start playing a harmony. And of course, in order to play a harmony, you've got to be on another Mini Moog.
Yeah. So it's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was great. I mean, the hardest thing when I first went out with multi keyboards was nobody made keyboard stands. So I used to buy a chest of drawers in rummage shops, take the drawers out. We used to alter the thing so we could slot the keyboards in because there was no other way to do it. Nobody made stands or anything. Shows how bloody old I am.
You know, I can't believe we haven't got to Yes yet, but there's no one else to blame for the length of this podcast other than yourself, Rick.
Yeah.
but when you left Straubs, that's what I love about those days when keyboard players were real heroes, you know. When you left Straubs and went to Yes, that was front page news and all. It was like a football transfer, wasn't it, in those days?
Well, it was weird because, as you might know or not know, on the same day, David asked me to form Spiders from Mars with him and Mick, which was very weird, which I suppose is equivalent now being, you know, do you want to sign for Manchester City or Chelsea, I suppose. Yeah, but it was a bizarre thing. But Yes, I just felt Yes.
Hang on, can I just add something here, Rick, which is that surely it's a great compliment to you that the Spiders then went on without a keyboard player.
They did, yeah.
It's like Garson turned up during the American tour.
Well, yeah, the world wouldn't have had Mike Garson if you hadn't have...
That's true. I know Mike well. That's true. But initially, when they went out on the Spiders tour, they didn't really do stuff from Hunky Dory.
Yeah.
It was very much a Spider. I mean, I did a couple of tracks on the Spiders album, and they didn't really. He went back to being a very much a guitar. It was very Mick Ronson led.
Yeah. But in fact, because Hunky Dory didn't really take off till after Ziggy Stardust, did it? So I was saying, because it must have been disappointing at the time. Because, I mean, it's an absurdly brilliant album. And it must have been very disappointing that it, because it didn't happen, did it, when it came out?
But that's happened a lot in the early days with David, interestingly enough. I mean, when you consider Space Oddity, first time around, I got that number four or something. And it wasn't until 1973,
I think.
Re-release,
when it finally got to number one. So it's not uncommon for David. And Hunky Dory was at the time really an acquired taste. It had to be something that you had to go, what's this? There was nothing else quite like it around. Mm-mm. I mean, one of the things was David's influences. When I was around at Haddon Hall, I went around quite a few times. We chatted a lot.
Backtracked us. I've taken us back to Haddon Hall now.
Yeah, but he's emotional about Haddon Hall.
I know. I love it.
Just the one thing.
It's the Haddon Hall special.
I asked him who his influences were. And he played me a track, and I thought it was David. And I said, oh, when did you do this? He said, it's not me. He said, it's a guy called Biff Rose.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh.
And Biff Rose.
Song for Biff. Song for Biff.
That's it. And there was Fill Your Heart With Joy, which is a Biff Rose song. If you get hold of a Biff Rose album and listen, on certain tracks you'll go, you can play it to people and they'll go, well, that's David. Very interesting. But anyway, going back to Yes. So I decided to go for Yes because I always think for me, music is give and take. You've got to be able to give as much to the music as you can take out of it. And I did feel that, obviously with David, much as I love playing David's stuff, David's tracks and David's music and having a lot of freedom to be able to play whatever I liked, in the nicest sense, much as I love David's songs, it would always be David. There would be a ceiling as to how far I could go and what to do. Whereas with Yes, who, in fact, as Strawls, we supported Yes in Hull once, and I'm watching the band and thinking, this is a very different band. This is a band that, I'd love to be able to offer certain things too.
Because you took over from Tony Kaye, didn't you? You took over from Tony Kaye on the Fragile.
Yeah. Tony, great player, and he's very much a rock player. And I wasn't thinking much about it, but certainly Bill, Steve, and Chris were very much of the orchestral nature, and I thought I could have a field day here, but never thought much about it. And then I got a call from Chris 2 o'clock in the morning, which is roughly when Chris gets up or used to, and he went, Chris Squire, yes, yeah, I went, do you know what the time is? And he went, yeah, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went, well, I've got to be up at half past five. I've got a session in London. He said, we're just back from America. He said, and we want to go much more down the orchestral rock route and thought that it might be something that might interest you. And I said, well, it does, but not at half past two in the bloody morning. And he went, I'll call you again later then. And I went, yeah. And it was later on, in fact, it was the Brian Lane manager who called me and said, did you get a call from Chris? I said, yeah, up past two in the morning. He went, yeah, sounds like him. And he said, what do you think? And I said, well, yeah. I do love the band. The Yes album had come out and done right. So I really do like what they're doing. I do feel that that if they want to go in the orchestral directions, kind of the orchestral rock direction, that, you know, it's a sort of, in a direction that I'm looking at going in, so it would work all the way around. And I said, but you know, we've got to make sure it's going to work for everybody. So what we did, they had a rehearsal place booked in Shepherd's Market in Mayfair, which was above what I thought was a shop, but turned out not to be a shop because even though it was summer, there were lots of women in fur coats walking outside in and out, and the crew kept vanishing, so I realised suddenly it was not actually it wasn't a sweet shop. Well, it was, I suppose, in some respects.
It was a shop, but it just had the word knocking in front of it.
Yeah, and but the first two days when I was there, we had we pretty much put together Roundabout and Heart of the Sunrise. I thought, I like this. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle pieces going together. And I used to run Steve back to his flat in Hampstead because Steve never drove back then. So we did that. And then on the second day, they said, look, how do you feel about this? And I said, I'm really enjoying this. And I think I'd like to think that I've got things to offer. Certainly the music's got, and the ideas have got a lot to offer to me, so I think it could work. And they said, well, we're really happy. So I said, great. And that night was when David had called me and said, can you meet me at Hampstead Country Club with Mick Ronson? I want to talk to you about something.
What a crossroads.
I know. So I sat down with Mick and David, and David said, they were doing a little duo thing there for fun. And he said, look, we've got this idea of Spiders from Mars, you know, because you've done a couple of the tracks. Would you, you know, and he said, I'd really like you and Mick to sort of put it all together and with Trevor and Woody and that kind of thing. How do you feel? And I said, God, bloody hell, this is turning into quite a day. And he said, well, I said, well, yes, they've just asked me to join them.
Did the landlord get her money that day? I think she
yeah, and he said, well, have a think and get back to me. And in the meantime, they went up and I got up and did a couple of tracks with them on the stage. They had a piano or a keyboard there, and I did something, which was great. And I thought about it long and hard, and I thought, well, there's more I can do with Yes than there is with David, much as David was the most influential person I ever worked with. So I called him up the next day and told him, and he said, absolutely the right decision. And interestingly enough, when I lived in Switzerland, he was a very close neighbour, and we used to meet a lot down a little club called the Museum Club in Montreux and put the world to rights. And we met a lot and talked to him a lot about it. He said, you absolutely made 100% the right decision. He said, because all the different projects that came on after, he said, I changed the band anyway. He said, so the chances are you'd be out of work now anyway. And he said, remember what I told you, always pick the musicians that are right for whatever job it is you're doing. And he said, so I chopped and changed around a lot. He said, yeah, he said, I think you would have enjoyed yourself in Spiders, but it was the wrong decision. You made
Rick, I just want to ask you a little sidebar question, which is because Guy and I love prog. We love progressive music, whatever it was called initially. But, you know, who began, do you think? Because, you know, it could be you. You could be the guy who brought that classical Baroque, mixed it with folk, mixed it with rock, and that scene started and went into Genesis. Or was it Keith in Nice doing, you know, Five Bridges? Where do you think it was?
I think it's a mixture of all of it. I think it's a mixture of all of these little tributaries running into a sort of an estuary and then into a river.
I think I've heard you say before that you actually thought Pink Floyd were the birth of prog.
I think Pink Floyd certainly played a massive part when they first started, because it seemed to me that that they were one of the first bands to sort of, because they'd all played popular music. They all knew what popular music was, so they knew the rules, but were quite happy to break them.
Yeah, but it wasn't the music. Whereas your thing was more expanding the musical horizons, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, very much so. I mean, I think. I mean, to me, the definition of prog is knowing the rules and then breaking them. I mean, it doesn't mean to say you can't still break them, but it's hard to break them if you don't know what they are, because you can break them properly, which is what a lot of the Eastern European classical composers did. There's a wonderful book called Art and Principles of Orchestration, which Rimsky-Korsakov wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
And it basically, shows how he broke every rule that there was. And I loved that, and I that's the principle I work on. And the interesting thing is, of course, it was at a period of time when it was very much, there was a singles market and there was an album market. And the singles market was still very much of the pop era, to a lot of extent, still a lot of beat bands and that floating around. And the music was, to a large extent, formatted, you know, with intro, verse, chorus, solo, intro, verse, fade out if you can't think of an ending, that kind of thing. And the albums were, you could have longer tracks and all that kind of thing.
I'm gonna jump you one of your jokes. Guy, you know, what do you call the first 10 minutes of a Yes song?
What? Introduction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did the cape come from? We're going to talk about the cape.
Come on, we're going to talk about it. Because it is, I was thinking, it's actually, with Prague, it's like the greatest trope, right? Well, there's two. There's the cape and the gong. That's it. Those are the two things that just scream Prague, aren't they?
But I had a little band at school, and my mate Jess Bailey, he was on the keyboards, and you know had to get another keyboard to make that L shape. He wore the cape, you know.
But I heard an interview with you where you actually said it's actually a very, very pragmatic reason for having a cape.
There is. Yes. There is absolutely pragmatic. Basically, it was my first Yes tour, 1971, and. Again, there were no cable stands or anything, so I had all this furniture around. I was like a walking advert for IKEA.
Were going to wear your keyboards and a cape like Flash Harry with his watches?
Well, no, but what happened was all keyboards then basically did one thing. There wasn't presets, anything like that, or programming. So basically it took forever to set them up. And so what I did, I had every keyboard that would take a sustain pedal had one. And also you had to have a volume pedal on them because they were all so noisy because none of the lineouts matched at all. So it was a ridiculous amount of noise that came out. So I had all these pedals. So if I wasn't using something, I'd sort of, with the foot, get the sound off. So at least the sound of the keyboard could be louder than the hums, noises and buzzes that came out. But because of the keyboards, they were all balanced up and the pedals were all of different lengths with the cabling, I had them up on sort of bits of plinth and bits of wood. So when I played, there was one leg up, and I couldn't do it now, one leg up, and yeah, I got into positions that, crikey.
Kama Sutra.
I rewrote it. It was everything was fine. I was quite happy sticking arms up, looking at, and then we were fourth on the bill to like 10 years after and a few other bands in 1971, basically playing when people were coming in. Which was great. So you never got a review. But then suddenly we got a review. Don't ask me where I went or why, but we got this review and it was really nice. It said, the opening band were a band called Yes from England. It was very kind. So what fine musicians it went through. So it's unusual a player Steve was with what he did, and the same with with Bill Rubin and everybody. And then of course with John having an alto voice, which was very unusual for a rock band, and Chris's bass, which was basically treble turned full up, bass turned full up, and all the middle wound out. And then he wrote some very nice things about me, about technically what I did, and said my only criticism of Wayne would be that because his arms and legs seem to have to go to all over the place in order to reach his pedals and do things, he did at times appear to look like a demented spider. And I went, what's that? And the following night when we played, I was very conscious of this and we're like, well, shit, he's right. I am. His arms and legs. I was going into positions that you just really wouldn't even think about. And I thought, well, there's nothing I can do about it. And I spoke to Michael Tate from Tate Towers, the great lighting guy, and who was on the road with us. And Mike said, we've got to find a solution to this. He said, it may be that we may have to build like a sort of a turret around all the keyboards so that people actually can't see their legs. And he said, that might work.
That's very Prague, an actual castle.
Yeah, a little castle. And then we played Hartford, Connecticut in a little baseball stadium, which ironically I passed 2 weeks ago when I went through Hartford to get to somewhere else in Connecticut. A little minor league ground, and they were holding a festival there, and which was everything being introduced by the local DJ, which they all were back then. And we were one of about a dozen bands on, so we're waiting to go on, and I noticed that the guy doing the introduction, the DJ, had a cape on. There's a 3/4 length cape with a big star and a moon on the back, and I didn't think much about it. I thought, well, that's interesting. And then after he'd introduced us, he turned round, and he was, how can I put it politely? He was on the large size. He was large side. He was, well, he was
large big. And in charge.
Absolutely, he was big. And I remember thinking as he walked over to the side of the stage where I was, thinking that cape hides a multitude of sins. There's my. So he came.
And
just
chins.
Yeah, we were on $200 a week. And then we had to pay everything out, all our food and drinks, and pay everything out of that. And I'd got 10 $20 bills we'd just been paid in my back pocket. And he came to the side of the stage. I said, I want to buy your cake. And he said, it's not for sale. I said, and I did the old Wheeler Dealers thing. I took out the $10-$20 bill. I said, I've just been paid. This is all the money I've got in the world. I will not be able to eat this week. I want to buy you a cake. And he looked at the money and went, you're all right then. So I gave him the money. Meanwhile, the band are going apeshit because we only had 30 minutes to play and I've already wasted 10 of it doing a deal with the cake man. I put it on. And of course, on me, he was only about 2'7". On me, it was only a half-length cape. So I walked on and played. And it sort of felt, you know, really quite good, sitting around the shoulders and things, it covered. And Michael Tate came back after. He said, that's the answer, but not that. He said, first of all, not a short cape, three-quarter length or half length. He said, it needs to be full length. It needs to be heavy. It needs to be something that can work with lights. And he said, that's what you need. And if you do that, then we're there. And I said, well, where am I going to get capes like that? He said, I know a girl who makes them. She's a designer and she'll make them for you. She's in Cleveland. We're playing Cleveland. I'll introduce you and she'll make it for you. And that's how the first cape came about. All of the major shows I did, there was a new cape came along.
Wow.
Which the band used to find.
Do you still have to? Is there sort of the Rick Wakeman Museum of Capes?
There is a wardrobe with five of the six, what I call classic capes in. It's hard to get them insured. I mean, I've been offered...
Oh, tell me about it.
Ludicrous money for them.
But what I think it represents as well, I mean, to me as a kid, everything you did was only serious. To me, there was a serious reason that you just looked incredible in this cape. Superhero stuff. But I suppose, really, it sort of revealed a bit of your humorous side as well, didn't it, Rick? Which, as a person, you are.
Yeah. But this is going to sound really, really strange. But when I'm doing the one-man show or the piano shows or whatever, I don't wear a cape because it's really hard at the piano. Because it's so bloody heavy, they make you want to fall inside it. But when I do the band shows and rock shows, it's really strange. It's I was talking to an actor friend of my great friend, Peter Egan, and we sort of compared it a bit like if he's playing Henry V in Shakespeare, he can do all the rehearsals, all the various things. When he walks on in the costume,
suddenly
you're there. And Dave Bowie always said, be a different person on stage to off. And he did it by actually changing characters, which was absolutely brilliant. And you do feel, I feel underdressed if I haven't got a cape on.
Yeah. It's like Adam Adamant, isn't it? In his cape at the beginning, you know. I saw you recently, just a couple of
years. Dr. Fibes.
3 years ago, wearing it at the O2 when you were there with Yes as well.
We did.
I would have been disappointed if you hadn't been.
Oh, it had to be. I mean, I had some major. The funniest one, the most daring and ridiculous one, was when we, for my 70th birthday, where we redid Journey to the Centre of the Earth at the Festival Hall again. We did a couple of nights there with the orchestra, choir, and kitchen sink and whatever, and that was really great fun. And I had some. I had an original cape for that, which was good. I wore two. But the most ridiculous was back in 2009 when I did Henry VIII, All the Six Wives at Hampton Court. And I booked these actresses to play the wives. And after we sort of walked on, my manager said, well, what are you going to do with them now? They're just going to have them hanging around doing nothing. And he said, come up with something. And he said, how many cape changes you got? I said, well, two at the moment, that's all. He said, well, why don't you have a cape change for every track? He said, so you've got six wives and you've got a Henry track and you've got an encore. So eight cape changes. So I had eight cape changes each one of the wives walked on with a different cape. One took one off and the other one put one on. I mean, it was so glad. Mark Boland would have been delighted. But
Rick, eight cape men.
Yeah, that'll do.
You know what? This is killing me, Guy, because I thought, you know, we've got to have to get onto the solo albums.
We've got to do the solo. I'd say, because this is in parallel, isn't it? This is the extraordinary thing. You join Yes, and you're kind of straight into these solo albums, which are always huge themes. Was that something called you? No.
Do you remember? Because I remember really distinctly seeing Rick doing Six
King
Wives. Six Wives on Old Grey Whistle Test.
Oh, well, that's quite right.
But that's legendary.
Yeah. And how brilliant that was.
Yeah,
it was really good. I mean, the thing was, all the best things are never really planned. They happen. And what the situation was, a lot of record companies had been taken for a bit of a ride by bands and managers by a band signing a deal and then one of the guys leaving to form his own band and going and doing another deal somewhere else, and then that band disbanding after the record company had laid out a load of money to the original band. And so record companies started to get a bit cute about that. And A&M were one. And when they signed a band, they signed the band both as a band and severally as well as individuals. But the individuals were all on options. So if the record company, somebody left, the record company had an option to get them to do something or just let them go. And basically it was on that first Yes tour in 1971. We were in Los Angeles, and my manager, he said, "We've got a message from A&M. Jerry Moss wants to see you at A&M Records." So went down to see Jerry Moss, who was a lovely, lovely guy. And their offices, their lot, it was great. A&M Records were on what they was called the lot, which was Charlie Chaplin's film studios.
Yeah, yeah, I mixed an album in there. It's beautiful.
Oh, did you? A brilliant, brilliant place. And it was interesting because... I won't digress, but I ended up when I ended in Switzerland. Charlie Chaplin was my neighbour, so it was quite. I did tell him I'd recorded on his lot.
My hero.
Anyway, that's by the way. So I went in to see Jerry Moss, and Jerry said, "You know, we have a clause in the Storms contract for you to take you up as an option to do a recording for." And I said, I didn't, but if you tell me I did, you know. And he said, "Well, how would you feel about making an album for us?" And I said, "Wow, I'd love that." He said, "Oh, that's really good." He said, "So it'll be the same deal for the same money that Storm's got, which was $12,000, which worked out about £4,000. And he said, "There's no rush, but as long as we can have it by the end of next year," which was 1972. He said, "Because we would want to put it out in 1973 at the beginning." I said, "Great, fine." And he said, "Okay, signing on as well." He said, we'd like to give you a present." And I said, "This is just gets better by the minute." And he said, "Anything up to $1,000 if it's something you'd like." This is 1972. "Is there anything?" And I went, "Yeah." He said, "What is it you want?" I said, "Well, there's a car lot on Sunset Strip, on the strip just down from the Wright House, the Hart House." Yeah. And I said, "It's got in there a 1957 Cadillac limo. It looks a bit falling apart, and they want $975 for it." And I said, "That's what I'd like." Huh. And he said, "Are you mental?" And I said, "No, that's what I'd like." And he went, "Okay, all right." And he said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "we'll ship it back for you as well." And they did.
Whoa.
And I took it, weighed 3 ton, did 2 miles to the gallon.
Not very medieval, though, is it?
I had it all restored. It was fantastic. I loved it. All restored, and then lost it in my first divorce.
But listen, you know, Six Wives, you know, for me, I pictured these individual women, you know, the Jane Seymour track, whatever it might be. You seem to inform me as a listener, because I mean, this was an instrumental album. I've never bought an instrumental album in my life. Mm. You informing me as a listener, something about their personalities, even if there is Baroque, there might be also a little bit of grooviness about them.
Yeah. Well, what I did was there was two routes you can go down. You either go down the Tudor music period and make it sort of Tudor rock kind of thing, or whatever you can do with Tudor instruments or that kind of sound.
Mock Tudor.
Mocked you like it, rock Tudor. But what I did, I mean, I like going to art galleries and things, and I like all sorts of music. And sometimes if you go to a gallery of a lot of surrealistic paintings, you know, it's sort of, just to generalize, you can go and see a painting with three splodges on it and something else that's ridiculous, a triangle or whatever, and it can be called Moscow at moonlight, you know.
You did push Salvador Dali off a stage once, is that true? Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it is true, yeah.
He
screwed up my piano solo, so he had to go.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it has to happen.
It's your Abbie Hoffman moment.
But one of the things that I did understand reading about these different artists, is that that's what is in their mind when they're doing their painting. So it's what is in their head as to what they paint. And I thought, I'd like to do that musically. So I read about All of the Wives. I made loads of notes. I mean, books full of notes about the wives. So I do with every project I do. And then whilst I was writing or reading about one of them or whatever, what I would, if something came to mind, an idea, I'd write it down. If I was by a piano, great, I'd write it on the piano. Or if I was in a plane, I'd write it on a piece of manuscript. So I would build up all these ideas for All of the Wives. And if I thought, it's like Jane's, Catherine Howard, who was probably only about 19, nobody knows for sure when Henry chopped her head off. But she seemed to be a bit of a game girl, shall we say. She seemed to be a bit of a good tiger, which is why I put what I call the fun bits and things in the middle. It was that kind of thing. So it was meant to be almost paint your own picture.
And for me as a kid. I mean, listening to that music, you know, it expanded my horizons. Living in a little council house, this was glorious, sumptuous, historic, modern stuff.
And didn't you ask to perform it at Hampton Court?
Yeah, 2009. We did it at Hampton Court.
Oh, you did it?
Yeah, we did it. 2009.
I thought you were accused of treason or something when you were.
Well, no, it was brilliant. I mean, it cost me a fortune because even we sold out the two nights. We could only allowed 5,000 people a night. We sold out the two nights and we worked out all the maths, and it was going to lose a large six-figure sum.
That's never stopped you before, though, has it, Rick?
No, it didn't stop me this time either. I went. This is it's. What other opportunity are you ever going to get to do this? So it was fantastic. I had a big orchestra, a big band, a massive stage built with lots of stuff.
Impulse.
It was just astonishing. I mean, and I'm glad it did get out of hand. I mean, I must admit, one of the funniest things was needed. Because normally, instead of chatting between each of the numbers, my conductor, Guy Prothero, he said to me, look, you've got a problem. He said, because you've got a lot of stuff to change and redo. He said, if you're going to do a bloody costume change as well, he said, how are you going to talk to the audience? He said, you need someone to do it. So I thought, who could be really good at doing this? And I phoned up Brian Blessed. And he was sensational. Although I gave him the script.
Probably didn't need to go through the PA.
No, well, I gave him the script. He said, do you want me to stick to the script? And I thought, well, he knows a lot about the Tudor period. I said, no, feel free to alter it around. Well, he did quite a lot.
On Six Wives, was it?
Oh, it was fun. I mean, I got a call from Universal when it was all done, because it was filmed. And they said, look, we've got a bit of a problem. You're either going to have to edit Brian severely, or we're going to have be the first music concert video that has to have a PG rating on it. He said, and it's true. I mean, Brian would do things like say, instead of saying Henry consummated his union with Anne Boleyn prior to their actual marriage, he would say things like, dirty old sod gave her one everywhere he could, in the kitchen, all over the place. He'd do all of that. I mean, it was brilliant. He really brought it to life.
The trustees of Hampton Court must have loved it.
It was hilarious. He was so good, Brian. He was a lovely man. And so it all worked. It was amazing. I'm glad I did it. As I say, it took me 2 years to pay for it, but I'm glad I did it, because what other opportunity was the 500th anniversary of his accession to the throne? So it doesn't get any better than that.
Well, okay, so we'll talk about the big production. So we've got to go to King Arthur.
Yeah.
On ice.
On ice.
I mean, on ice.
I mean, what?
I mean, it has to be said, first of all, as we said, the millions and millions of records that Six Wives and Journey to the Centre of the Earth and the myths and legends of King Arthur that they sold. I mean, these are huge, huge records. No one would believe that today, right? You know, instrumental albums, massive.
That's true. But I always played what I call Blackjack Dublin up. So the money I earned from Six Wives paid for Journey, because I only got the same advance, $12,000, £4,000 to do Journey. So I used all the money from Henry to pay for Journey, and used all the money from Journey to do the orchestral tour in America with it, and to help pay for King Arthur.
You're sort of doing a pyramid scheme on yourself.
Yeah, which sooner or later, of course, goes wrong. Yeah. But eventually it did. But
someone has to pay, and it's going to be you.
Yeah. But if you're going to invest, I suppose invest in yourself to some extent. But King Arthur, I wanted to do it at Wembley. Wembley Empire Pool, I wanted to do it there. I love that venue, always have
done.
Yeah. And Brian Lane, my manager, and Harvey Goldmine, Goldsmith, wanted to do it. At, they wanted to do it at the Albert Hall. And I said, it's the wrong place. Yeah. It's the wrong place. And they came back to me and said, well, you can't do it at the Wembley. And I said, why not? And they said, because there's an ice show going in there and it takes 3 weeks, which it did then, to deal with the ice and all of that.
No, so you can't.
And the only dates that are available you could have are when the ice is down. I was so furious. I thought they're trying to fob me off here. So, and ice skating wasn't popular, but I loved it. I'd had quite a lot of music used, especially by the Russians, for the ice skating stuff. And I really loved it. And I thought this could really depict, this could be great fun. So
That's brilliant lateral thinking. That's extraordinary lateral thinking.
Well, I got in the car and I drove up to Red Lion Square in London off Fleet Street, which is where Melody Maker was.
Yeah.
Dumped the car, went in there, and Ray Coleman wasn't there, but Chris Welsh was. And I said to Chris, do you fancy a drink? And he went, yeah, yeah. So we went into the pub and he said, so what are you up to? What are you doing? And I said, oof. Well, it's all a bit hush hush, really. And he went, "What's that?" I mean, I love Chris. I speak to him a lot. Still a great friend. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm doing the King Arthur album." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, the concert, we're doing it at on ice." And he went, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, Empire Pool. We're doing it on ice." And I said, "I'm building a big castle in the middle, with the orchestra and everything to quite be there." I said, "The skaters will all run out, and we'll all be in the big castle." All of the world champion skaters doing that with, I said, there'll be hundreds of them, be brilliant. And I said, but it's all hush hush, don't say a word, will you? And he went, no, don't worry. This was on a Wednesday, Thursday morning when Melody Maker came out, which you could get your first copies at Tottenham Court Road. There it was at the front, Arthur on Ice. And I thought, I knew it was going to happen. My manager went apeshit. He said, you better come and see me. How are we going to get? He said, well, you've got to do it now. I said, oh, yeah, okay, then. So we did. And but there was a lot of firsts in that because no one had ever hung a PA before in there. And there wasn't there were no rigging points. So Clare Brothers came in from America and they put a series of nets up to house all of the PA and everything. Oh, I mean, there were massive, massive technical difficulties with the whole thing. But it was just fantastic fun. And I want to do it again. I'm determined before I depart this mortal coil to do it again because you can do so much more now with ice.
We've got to have the story about the last night.
Oh, the last night. It was bloody funny, actually.
Not with a K.
Well, there was the piece towards the end of King Arthur called The Last Battle, and what we'd arranged would be. A lot of the skaters as knights, about 50 of them. Well, it was 50 of them. And they all, we had dry ice all over the surface and they had like hobby horses. So the little heads poked out the top and they were on there with their swords. And it was great because you couldn't see the lower half of the body. And it was like they floated round. And basically we played the last battle. They would skate round and pair up. And then at the given time in the music, they would draw each other with the sword and then disappear and die into the dry ice. Well, that night, there was a wonderful guy called Tony Birdfield who worked for Annette, sadly no longer with us, as indeed most of them are who took part in that. He came to me, he said, Rick, and I had a technical problem at the time with one of the keyboards. And he came to me, he said, Rick, we've got a bit of a problem. I said, not now, Tony. I'm up to my neck. I've got a huge technical problem here. He said, well, there's another problem. I said, oh, what is it, Tony? He said, one of the skaters is ill and not coming. And I said, Tony, there's about 120 of them. If one's ill, it doesn't matter. He went, well, it will do. I said, no, it's fine. But it was only when we started doing the last battle and they all started skating around with the knights that it came to me as they all paired up to understand what the difficulty was. And the difficulty was it was obviously one of the knights that had been taken ill and wasn't coming in because there was this one knight left who had no one to pair up with. So after the others had all killed themselves and dropped into the dry ice, there's this poor sod like skating around looking for someone to kill him. And, and I'm at the keyboard, the conductor, the late David Measham. David Measham's like that. And he went looking at me going, what did I? And I said, and as you know, all there's lots of letter points on music and orchestra. And I said, whatever, go J to K, keep going round. So he made signals to the orchestra and just kept going round wherever it was, J to K, while this poor sod's going around looking for someone to kill him. Now, by this time, the audience have sussed it. They've absolutely sussed exactly what's happened. And they're all like sitting back going, how's he going to get out of this one? And I was just about to say to David Measham, look, just stop it. We'll just stop. And that's all we can do. When this guy, a stroke of genius, committed suicide. He got the sword, stabbed himself and disappeared, and got an ovation like you would not believe. I wish to this day that I'd taken the guy's name to thank him, because he's folklore.
Well, if he's listening... If he's listening.
Rick, we can't keep you any longer. You are just unbelievable. Oh, well, we could. I could listen to you all night, and we may have to get you back one day.
Do it again if you're brave enough.
We'll have Close to the Edge. We'll have The Breakup. We'll have Topographic Oceans.
Yes. Well, your whole Burton Taylor type relationship with Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know, every time you went back, it was like Ronaldo going back to Man United, wasn't it?
There's an element in that. Yeah, always happy to do it again, guys.
Listen, good luck.
Joyous, yeah.
You're not so grumpy at the moment, though, are you? Now it's not quite as grumpy tour for you now, isn't it?
No, grumpy's. I always think of grumpy as funny. Grumpy is something where you laugh, and you go, yeah, but it's true. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, we'd love to come and see you when you play.
Absolutely.
Wherever you're playing near us.
Where's home for you?
Well, I'm in London. He's down in...
I'm in London and Brighton. So, yeah. Bi-coastal.
Where are you playing in London?
We've got Cadogan Hall coming up.
Lovely, beautiful.
Oh, beautiful venue.
Yeah, so sort that for you if you like.
Yes, absolutely. Fantastic. We'll make a night of it, shall we, Guy?
And yes, with a K.
Brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much, Rick.
Absolute joy, mate. Absolute joy talking to you. That's a close tie with Joe Elliott for the least we've said in an episode of this.
I know. I was beginning to get bored with myself.
Same here. I didn't want to interject, but we had to. I mean, oh, man.
He's so good, isn't he?
He's so good.
We didn't get the Rick Wankman story. Apparently, that is... And that's a great...
I'm not even going to say... We need an acronym. BST... BSTS.
What is that?
Barely scratched the surface.
We did. We BSTS'd it. But we got the roots of prog, which is
yes,
good for us, right? But listen, I mean, what amazing... I mean, his career, we missed out about 90 albums.
Yeah, but we didn't even mention the Norman Wisdom one.
The Norman Wisdom one.
I mean, what...
Listen, people use National Treasure and people use the word legend, but that guy, this guy really is, isn't
absolutely
he? 100%.
Yeah.
Well, shall we see you next week? I see you next week, Guy. Do you think we should do this again?
I think, shall we?
Shall we?
Nothing else going on.
Will I end up as the last knight? And it's good night from me and me.
Very good.
All right. And it's good night from me.
And me.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.